Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Niall or Nine podcast. It's myself, Niall Byrne, and my co-host, Andrea Cleary.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I hit the mic there. Sorry.
I hit the mic anyone. To breathe in. How are you?
I'm good. Oh, I don't know why I've just remembered this now. The other day I was on YouTube and I saw it was suggested to me the Beastie Boys doing SNL when they come out from like the subway.
Oh yeah.
And I was like really annoyed that like you hadn't ever told me about that because it's really cool. I was like, why has Niall never told me about this? But then I gathered that it was actually quite a famous performance and I probably just should have known about it myself, but it's
Listen,
brilliant.
We've never done a podcast about Beastie Boys performances, but if you want one, I can make one for you. I could definitely do a list on the 100%. Website if I remember nothing else to write about, and that'd be a good one.
Yeah. Please do. But yeah, I thought of you and it was amazing and I ended up watching loads more performances.
Great. I actually did catch a let's just like completely divulge or diverge from what we were going to talk about for a second already. And yeah. When I was in London a couple weeks ago, I went to this exhibition called Beyond the Streets and it was like a street art exhibition. But it also had a lot of like music stuff in there. There's a big thing about the Clash with their backdrop because it had a graffiti backdrop from a New York writer who stayed in London. And then for some reason, not really 100% sure because it's not exactly graffiti or street art, but there was a Beastie Boys section where they had the three lads Adidas tracksuits that they wore in their mid 2000s tour probably and loads of memorabilia and paraphernalia from the band themselves, including the one thing that I really liked, which was it was around the Paul's Boutique era, and it was Mike D. I'll actually read it out to you because it's very funny. So basically they were recording the album, and at the time they were recording the album they were in LA and they were staying in a hotel, of course, being the lads that they are. They were a bit very messy and they were doing things they shouldn't have done. The hotel was called the Mondrian. Here is, it says, to Mr. Yauk. Oh, it's actually Adam Yauk. MCA. Suite 801 from Klaus Ortlieb, general manager. This is a memorandum. Regarding falling items from window. Date, August 8, 1988. Dear Mr. Yauk, I have received several complaints that are items falling out of your window and hitting people on the sidewalk. Please let me know if there's anything defective on your windows so we can eliminate this problem. I'm looking forward to your cooperation in this matter, respectfully. Klaus.
That's an excellent
Very good.
Memo.
Passive aggressiveness to the max.
Let us know if there's a problem with the window.
yeah. It couldn't possibly be it. You, of course.
That's great.
But
Yeah. No, sir, I would not suggest for a moment that you were responsible for the items.
But listen, if things are falling out the window, there must be an issue. There must be something going wrong. Let us know
there
what we can do.
There must be an issue.
So
yeah. That's hilarious.
But anyway, we've completely taken the podcast car off the motorway and driven it into the local town. And now we're back on the motorway. And Andrea, what is this episode about? Episode 215. What are we going to be discussing?
So episode 215 of the 909 podcast is about Cass Elliot, also known as Mama Cass, but we don't call her Mama Cass because she didn't like to be called Mama Cass. So we won't call her Mama Cass. I wanted to do this podcast. So one of her solo songs became a viral sound on TikTok.
Of course. All right. This is where it comes from. I was going to ask.
Yeah, this is kind of the idea. The Pedro Pascal and what's his name? Very famous actor. Nicolas Cage. That meme of them looking at each other in the car from The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. Make Your Own Kind of Music by Mama Cass, or by Cass Elliot. Oh God, I can't believe I did it. Was the sound. And then it went viral. And the young people, as they do, became curious, like, what is this song? It's obviously amazing. Who is this person? And kind of doing a bit of a deep dive into her and her life and her legacy. And there has been a kind of a reappraisal of how she's been treated, or she was treated during her career. That is to say, very, very poorly. Mm. And even after her death, she was treated very, very poorly. You know, she was a visible fat woman in the 1960s and 70s who was just treated really poorly for that reason. And I wanted to just kind of, so I messaged you. And I was like, we should do an episode about Cass Elliot. And you were like, I don't know anything about her. And I was like, perfect. I will woman-splain Cass Elliot to you, which just sounds like a fun hour of my time.
Good.
I don't know about
I'm
you.
I'm up for this.
Once I believed that when love came to me,
yeah, so I guess I wanted to talk about like her life, her work. I will say, like, for anyone out there who is really into her and is really familiar with her story, there's a lot I'm going to be leaving out here. I'm not touching the Charles Manson stuff, okay? You can go and talk about that yourselves. Not for any political reasons. This episode would be 2.5 hours long if I went into all of that. I also won't be going near her her arrest in London.
All very intriguing
things. There's a bit I'm not touching
to Google
on.
For
I
sure.
I know, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you can go and find all that out. What I wanted to do is kind of explore what her legacy is and how she's been treated and how we might think about learning from how she was treated when it comes to how we treat women now in music. And I mean, I was going to ask you, what can you tell, what do you know about Cass Elliot? But I think the answer is basically not much. Kind of
that I don't know anything.
Okay, well, I'll tell you all about her. So she was born Ellen Naomi Cohen in September 1941 in Baltimore, Maryland. She is the granddaughter of Russian Jewish emigrants on both sides. And after she was born, her family moved to Alexandria in Virginia, and where she stayed until she was 15. And then they moved back to Baltimore again, where she started to become involved with kind of theater and musical theater in school. She left her high school to move to New York shortly before she graduated. And there she performed in musicals and sang and worked in as a cloakroom attendant for a number of years while also singing. And then moved from New York to Washington, D.C. to pursue a career as a singer, which I find interesting. Yeah, I mean, an overview of her musical projects. She joined a few bands. First, she was in The Big Three. The band named The Big Three with banjoist and singer Tim Rose and singer John Brown. And then in 1964, she, along with Zal Yanofsky and Denny Doherty, formed The Mugwumps, which is just a great name for a band. And Denny Doherty, who... okay, Denny. Denny Doherty, in the meantime, also formed a band called... The New Journeymen, who Cass would eventually join, and that would eventually become the Mamas and the Papas. But Denny Doherty was also the object of Cass Elliott's very much unrequited love. If you think Fleetwood Mac are complicated, this band are very, very, very complicated. So the Mamas and the Papas were made up of Cass, Denny, John Phillips, and the band's other female member, the singer and model Michelle Phillips. Michelle Phillips was married John Phillips. The like Fleetwood Mac complications come in when Michelle had an affair with Denny, who Cass was in love with, and there's all of that. And I'm not going to go too much into all of that either, but it was a very, very sad time for everybody, basically, but especially for Cass. But yeah, the Mamas and the Papas were born and would obviously come to be one of the defining sounds of the 1960s counterculture movement, really epitomized by their harmonies, their four-part harmonies, their quite introspective poetic lyrics, really evocative melodies. And when it comes to the sound of the Mamas and Papas, it is Cass Elliott who kind of really drives that sound. She has that really distinctive voice. She's got quite a low register and it's just beautiful. I mean, will we play the world's most famous Mamas and Papas song? Sure. Just in case there's someone out there who's not aware of
Let's
it.
Do it.
This is California Dreamin'.
All the leaves are brown.
So iconic and possibly overused at this point in terms of shorthand.
But
certainly
I've never once like not wanted to listen to
it's
it.
A great song.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, but yeah, it gets a lot of needle drops in cinema that can be a bit much.
Yeah.
I went to see a Wong Kar Wai film. I can't remember which one it was. It was part of the IFI festival, and that is used a lot in it. It's the needle drop happens maybe like 8, 9, 10 times throughout the film.
Wow.
That song.
That's a lot.
Which was very, very interesting. But I never get bored. Like if it ever comes on, I'm never like, oh, this song again. Like you would be with a lot of kind of classic songs that are so ubiquitous and so like part of the culture. But I never, ever get bored of that song. It's just so amazing and infectious. And as a person who loves kind of seasonal music, it's a seasonal song that literally fits into every single season. Maybe not spring, but like it's a song about being in New York in the winter. So you've got winter covered, thinking about being in California in the summer and missing that. And then it also just sounds autumnal and it's like all the leaves are brown. It's amazing. I love it so much. So yeah, they had a very, very, the band had a really sharp rise to fame with their first album in 1966, which is called If You Can Believe Your Eyes and Ears. And it was received quite well by the music press. Rob Sheffield for the Rolling Stone wrote, the Mamas and Papas celebrated all the sin and sleaze of 60s LA with folksy harmonies, acoustic guitars and songs that told inquiring minds way more than they wanted to know. And on their January 1966 debut, If You Can Believe Your Eyes and Ears, they somehow made it all sound groovy. I do kind of yearn for the days when the music press used words like groovy in a very, wow. in a very sincere way. I think that's
every
great.
Now and again, I want to use the word groovy in a review.
I think you should.
Just for the sake of it. But it's like, I just can't bring myself to do it. It's quite
let's try and do
it's
it.
It's real groovy, man.
At some
You're
stage.
Like, ooh,
it's just groovy.
Hard one to do. Like,
I know. It's a hard one to pull off, but if we could bring it back. Yeah. I'm just saying, I think, between us all.
I have used it.
And on that
album,
I have used it
this February, turns out.
Oh, there you go. In a piece on the website.
About a song. Yeah, I have.
Amazing. So.
You know, it's always there, the urge. The urge is always there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Bruce Eder wrote for AllMusic that the album embraced folk rock, pop and soul, and also reflected the kind of care that the acts like the Beatles were putting into their records at the time. And so, yeah, that song is obviously very, you know, familiar to a lot of people, but that groove, that grooviness is very much there on the album. There's a song called I Call Your Name off the album that I love. We can hear like a little clip of it maybe.
I call your name, but you're not there. Was I to blame for being unfair? You know I can't sleep at night. But
so the thing about when the Mamas and Papas happened, when they came out, everybody fell in love with Cass. She was the selling point. She was funny.
I read a little bit and I crochet a little bit and I watch television.
Yeah.
And I go out and carouse and burn down buildings.
She was personable. She would joke around with audiences while they were on stage. She was just so, so likable. And she received the most fan mail from fans of any person in the group. She was really celebrated for her voice and her personality and her talents. But there was also this flip side of how she was treated because of her size, because she was a fat woman, that just means that the narrative around her has always and probably will always carry this air of real sadness and tragedy. So I want to talk a bit about like how we treat women. This was my plan all along, Niall, to get feminism.
I thought it might be. You've been asking a lot of questions about women in music in the Discord and stuff lately. Yeah. So I thought this might be related.
Yes.
For sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, just for listeners, I'm going to be talking a bit in the next few sections about fat phobia and also a bit about food, and there might be some kind of triggering language. So if you're not up for that, then that's okay. But anyway, so like for me personally, like as a woman who was a girl in the 1990s, I'm definitely no stranger to how female pop stars are kind of treated with regards to their weight. And I also know that like the idea of a woman like Cass Elliot being a star when I was growing up just didn't feel possible. So there was this kind of like regression that happened between the 60s and the 90s. But in the 1960s, it was very, very difficult for her to be a pop star. She was a source of ridicule and humiliation because of her weight. It led to lifelong physical and emotional turmoil for her. It's really hard to overstate how obsessed people were with her size throughout her entire life. So as a child, her biographer writes that she started to put on weight when she was about 12. There was, you know, in the 1950s in America, there wasn't as many larger people around as there are today. And there were certainly no role models for her. And also this was a time before plus size fashion even existed, you know? So it's like you're talking about a girl who has to wear like men's clothing. And so when she was a teenager, her parents sent her to a psychoanalyst, which was in the 1950s, really like it's quite stigmatizing to be seeing a psychoanalyst as a young girl. And her family doctor prescribed her diet pills that contained amphetamines, which led to her, you know, losing concentration at school and not being able to kind of focus on her work. And like I said earlier, she did leave school before she graduated. But I mean, it was the 1950s, you know, like amphetamines were probably in everything that people were being prescribed. But still, it's an issue. And then even when she was in the Mugwumps, her second band, the record label that they were signed with expressed concern that her size was preventing them from being able to break through and become a more popular band. And they offered to pay for weight loss treatment for her, which she refused. John Phillips, one of the members of the Mamas and Papas, was reluctant to allow her to join the band. And Cass herself was kind of initially refused to go on stage next to Michelle. And the thing about Michelle is she was a model before she was in the band. Very, very beautiful, very, very thin. And Cass had this fear that audiences would compare the two women. Like, I can't overstate how poorly she was treated. Like, she guest starred on episodes of Scooby-Doo where she was like subjected to fatphobic jokes. Any television show that she appeared on, it was the butt of the joke. And her way of dealing with it was just to laugh along and make some of the jokes herself, which kind of in our current lens and our current understanding of like how the media treats people like that, it's completely obvious that it's a defense mechanism. And when you think about the 1960s and what the kind of idealized woman looked like in the 1960s, especially the idealized countercultural figure, it was this kind of rake thin, you know, androgynous figure like Edie Sedgwick or Twiggy. I think Twiggy was named like, you know, the face of 1966 or something like that, or like the woman of 1966. So there was very much a look for the counterculture. And I mean, the more we look into how the counterculture treated women in particular, the more that we understand that the kind of, you know, the peace and love element of it didn't always extend to people who weren't white men. but yeah, so labels just, you know, constantly offering to pay. They offered like a weight loss clinic then so that they could better market the band. She refused to take part in that, but the constant criticism did eventually lead to a life of very, very dangerous crash dieting, fasting, for a period of time, and just self-consciousness. There's a line in a song called Creek Alley that John wrote, which is no one's getting fat except Mama Cass.
Yeah,
in that 1967 song. Yeah, which is he was just really cruel to her. He didn't want her to join the band, as I said initially. And there's this weird story, right, where and like she's told this story and he's told this story, but the story from his point of view goes, he didn't want her to join the band because she didn't have a good enough voice. Then they were all away somewhere and she got hit in the head with like steel piping or something like that. And all of a sudden she could sing in a higher range, right? This was the story, and she was allowed into the band. Now, obviously, that's not true. Yeah. Like, we all can look at that now and say that that's not true. So something changed and he let her into the band. Maybe the other two members threatened to walk if he didn't let her in. But he always kind of resented how she looked and thought that she took away from the image of the band, which is ironic because she became the most recognized and the most loved member of the band. But yeah, he wrote that line about her, and you know, she sings on it, and it's very, very sad that happens. It's supposed to be like a play on like no one's getting rich. Like getting fat is supposed to be like a reference to her getting rich. But, you know, there's many other ways you can say that. I was going to play it, but you know what? Actually, let's not.
Okay.
I don't like it. All right, I'm going to skip forward in the timeline a little bit, but I will come back. Do you know anything about her death?
I did read a bit earlier on, so I do know what happened.
Okay, so she died when she was 32, which is incredibly young, but her death has, for decades, like since the day after she died, there has been this really awful urban legend, I suppose, that is perpetuated by very fatphobic stereotypes, was that she choked to death while eating a sandwich. And this rumor was kind of gleefully spread by the media. She's been the butt of jokes about her death ever since. In her biography, Dream a Little Dream of Me, the writer Eddie Fiegel writes about the doctor who first examined Cass after her death. He's named Dr. Greenberg, and he is responsible basically for this rumor. So this is from the biography. Greenberg immediately offered a straightforward explanation for Cass's death. His first impression, he told the press, was that it appeared to have been a simple case of asphyxia. From what I saw when I got into the flat, he told the Daily Express, she appeared to have been eating a ham sandwich and drinking Coca-Cola while lying down, a very dangerous thing to do. This would be especially dangerous for someone like Cass, who is overweight and who might be prone to having a heart attack. She seemed to have choked on a ham sandwich, he continued, unwittingly giving rise to the myth that would still be in circulation more than 3 decades later. What Greenberg had presumably overlooked is the small but pertinent fact that the sandwich by Cass's bed had not in fact been touched, as recorded by Inspector Kenneth Hum once the police were called. So it had absolutely nothing to do with what she was eating. It also, there were no drugs found in her system either, because there was also speculation that she had a drug overdose because she struggled with addiction and heroin addiction throughout her life as well. Her death and the joke about the sandwich, it reminds me a lot of the Elvis thing as well. Yeah. About the kind of the jokes that we have about Elvis's death, and just how, like, because I really had to interrogate that the Elvis one, because I mean, like, jokes about him like dying while he was on the toilet or it's actually like really, really horrible to think that I would have ever laughed at something like that, but I think I probably did in my younger years.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
I've really had to kind of like go and interrogate.
Well, it's
that
more
and
we accepted those things as absolute fact, and so when you accept those things, you're kind of like, oh, you never question it. You don't question these things at all.
Yeah.
So,
and it's just a way of like dehumanizing someone. It was a way to punish Elvis Presley for putting on weight, and it's a way to punish Cass Elliot for being quote unquote overweight. Although there's, you know, there's a lot of new evidence about quote unquote obesity, which suggests that she was actually not, like, she was technically overweight for her size, but there is no way on God's green earth a woman of 32 and the weight that she was should have died from a heart attack.
Yeah.
Due to being overweight. That's just not what it is. And I mean, there's loads and loads of new evidence about how the term obesity is not fit for purpose, that BMI scales are, you know, that they are developed from systems of white supremacy, and like all of this stuff is now just being kind of broken down and tackled. But what was actually most likely cause of her death was her crash dieting, in conjunction with her drug use, put a lot of strain onto her heart. And it was actually fat phobia and not being fat that caused her to die, which is, you know, there was an Irish Times article that I read today from 2004. I won't say who the writer is. I imagine he wouldn't write this now. But even in that piece that was kind of looking at the legacy of Cass Elliot, there was a line about her weight, like how much she weighed when she died, and comparing that to what a woman should weigh, you know, like a woman of her height and what she should weigh. And it's just so hard to get out of that mindset and get out of that space where you're blaming a woman for being overweight, when in fact it is in most cases of people being overweight who have heart problems, it's due to stigmatizing social conditions and not due to fat in their bodies. So basically, there was no food found in her esophagus. She didn't touch that sandwich, and there's no drugs found in her system. In the interest of kind of reappraising her legacy with this in mind, and just thinking about her as a whole person and not as like the butt of a joke or a full stop at the end of the Mamas and Papas, I want to take a bit of a look at her very interesting, not always the most cohesive, and certainly not boring, solo career after she met, or after she left, the Mamas and the Papas.
Okay.
So as the 1960s progressed, the band experienced a lot of internal issues. There was creative differences. Like I said, there was romantic conflicts, and there was the strain of touring that was starting to take its toll. And in 1968, Cass expressed an interest in pursuing some solo work away from the band. There's also always this kind of rumor that they kicked her out of the band because of how she looked. They didn't. They were trying to get her to stay in the band because she was the draw. And she was also at this stage a single mother, and wanted to spend less time on the road and more time at home raising her daughter. So she left the band in 1968, which was a complete shock to her fans and the industry at large. The band continued on for a little bit, but it would never be the same without her. And in the future, they did reunite for kind of one-off performances and things like that. So she then released her solo single, which was a cover, became a major hit, and remains one of the most famous and beloved recordings of the song to this day. And it's Dream a Little Dream of Me.
Good. Second.
Shining bright above you. Night breezes seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore tree. Dream a little dream of me. Say me, just hold me tight and tell me you'll miss me while I'm alone and blue as can be. Dream a little dream of me. Stars
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I sang that song for my Leaving Cert practical, and I was just as good as Cass, as you can imagine, given how much I sing these days.
I can tell you the first time I ever heard that song consciously was.
Please.
Do you remember the Help album from 1995? It was like a charity album. It had Radiohead's Lucky on it. I think it was the first time Lucky was ever appeared on anything.
Oh, no, I don't remember.
It was like a War Child compilation, and it had the Boo Radley, Stone Roses, Radiohead, Orbital, Portishead, Mass Attack, Suede, Dune Shipbuilding. This one, which I remember, which was done by Terry Hall and Salad. If you remember Salad,
there you go.
And UK band, the singer was called Marianne van der Vloot. There you go. That's where I heard that song for the first time ever. Anyway. That's that version.
Yeah, so this was, she signed with Dunhill Records and she was contracted to release 3 albums with them. And my cat is putting her tail on my face.
Yes.
And she produced her first album, which was called Dream a Little Dream, with John Simon, who previously worked with The Band, as in The Band, not The Band.
The Band.
The Moms and the Papas. The Band. And she really liked his work with The Band. And I mean, you can even hear at the beginning of that song, like there's some risks being taken. You know, it sounds like somebody's flicking through radio stations. It's going a little bit more out there. It's a little bit more experimental. And most of the songs were written by other people, written by people that she knew. The original title for the album was going to be In the Words of My Friends, but because the song did so well, they named the album after the song. The album, much like the rest of her career, never really settles on a distinct style. And that's often used as like a kind of as a failing on her part as a solo artist, but I think the diversity of what she sings and how she sings it, and the different styles that she sings in, is just one of the most like captivating things about her solo records. Like, I love her solo records, but I mean, this album alone has kind of like country, blues, jazz, rock, gospel, bluegrass, and then some songs that sound a bit more like the Mamas and Papas. And she said about her split from the band, "I have a lot of things inside me to sing, and I can't expect the others to wait around until I've got these things out of my system. It's not that I wanted to leave the group, it's just that I wanted to do some things on my own." But Dunhill Records weren't happy with her kind of eclectic approach to recording this album. They expected her to produce an album that was way more in the style of the Mamas and the Papas. And as such, they made the decision to basically not market it towards a mass audience and to just market it towards like kind of smaller groups. But I think it was during the promotion of this album that she was the first woman to be interviewed as a Rolling Stone like cover artist. This album is billed as Mama Cass, but she spoke to Rolling Stone around the time of this album being released about the name Mama Cass and how she wanted to actually move away from it. She said, "It's a stigma I might not be able to drop right away. I fought all my folk singing life. Before I was even with the Mamas and Papas, I hated it. Everybody'd say, 'Hey, Mama, what's happening?' Then came the Mamas and Papas and I was stuck with it. Now people call me Mama Cass because of the baby. So I don't know whether I'm going to be able to get away from it. So she always felt that you know, nobody was calling Michelle Mama. Like, there's a reason why she was called Mama, and it's to do with her size. And there's another song from this album, you know, she wanted to kind of move into writing songs or singing songs that were about issues, as it was the 1960s. And there's a great song in this album called California Earthquake. And she says about this, and we'll listen to it in a second. There's a song on my album called The California Earthquake. And the opening line is, I heard they exploded, the underground blast. What they say is going to happen is going to happen at last. That's the way it appears. They tell me the fault. They tell me the fault line run right through here. So that may be what's going to happen is going to happen to me. That's the way it appears. That's where it's at. My sister is a part-time clairvoyant. She says, get the baby out of here, move to Kansas. I say, look, I'm here now. There must be a reason I'm here. If that's fatalistic, be that as it may, where my work is, where my life is. And if we're falling into the ocean, we're falling into the ocean. The second verse says, Atlantis will rise, Sunset Boulevard will fall. And what could be more timely than that? That's where it's at. So she kind of, like, she's kind of a bit gas. Like, she's a bit gas. She's a bit mad. She talks about clairvoyance. Like, she's kind of into tarot and horoscopes. But she's also, you know, quite radical. And there was something about when she was talking about there, like, where my work is, where my life is, and we're falling into the ocean. That I was just like, that, you know, she could say that now, and that would feel like it was applicable to our kind of our current political circumstances. But California Earthquake is a great song. I think, do we have a clip of that? Yeah. Groovy. It's such a jam. That album's full of jams. Like, it's a really, really great album. And yeah, like I said, quite eclectic, quite wide-ranging in terms of styles. But like, her voice just really roots you. Like, any song she sings, you're like, oh, there she is. It's Cass. It's fine. I'm safe. You know? So in 69, she recorded her second album, which is called Bubblegum Lemonade and Something for Mama. Again, under the name Mama Cass, which was arranged and produced by Steve Barry. Her label didn't consider the debut album a success, so they really wanted a songwriting duo to come in the form of Barry Mann and Cynthia Wheel, to write some really commercially appealing songs to, like, get her up the charts. And she had three hits from this record, which were It's Getting Better, the cover Move In a Little Closer Baby, and the album was re-released then to include her hit single Make Your Own Kind of Music. And I don't need an excuse to play this, but I mean, I've led into it, so why not?
Nobody can tell you there's only one song worth singing. They may try and sell you, 'cause it hangs them up to see someone like you. But you've gotta make your own kind of music, sing your own special song, make your own kind of music, even if nobody else sings along. You're gonna be nowhere.
Wow, that's real, like, closing end credits big number funeral song, even. Like, it's like, just do it. Yeah.
Well, like, right before you said funeral song, I was going to say maybe you could play it at Lumo, but I didn't want to equate
that too. No, you could. I mean, it's a closing, it's a closer. It's definitely a closer.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great song. It's a really great song. And, you know, the more I read about her, the more this becomes my favorite of her songs, because it really does like have that message of self-love and self-confidence. And it's so applicable to so many different kinds of people. And it's so lovely and speaks to what music is supposed to actually be about instead of all this kind of bullshit. But I mean, so this was like her fun-loving, free-spirited album. But she wasn't always very comfortable in this space kind of either. She'd later question whether or not this material kind of really spoke to her and what she wanted to do. She spoke to Melody Maker in 1969, a week prior to the US release of the Make Your Own Kind of Music single, you know, to the absolute joy, I'm sure, of her label, who were trying to promote the single at the time. She described it as bubblegum music. And she said, "Bubblegum music is very pleasant to listen to, but it's like they say about Chinese food, half an hour after tasting it, you're hungry again." But she went on to say, "Maybe bubblegum is what I'm supposed to be doing, since my voice is very light. I just can't sing heavy material." And then later in 1971, she, speaking of her time with Dunhill Records, she said that she'd been forced to be so bubblegum that I'd stick to the floor when I walked. She wanted to record music that was kind of social commentary, and this didn't feel like the way to do it to her, which, you know, like I said, is a bit ironic to me, because I do think that this is an anthem for like any kind of marginalized person you can think of, and in terms of like finding an artistic voice and expressing who they are against social and cultural conventions. But she probably just didn't see this song as being, you know, crossing over in that kind of way. And maybe it didn't until the TikTok kids found it and kind
That's
of
so interesting.
Breathed new
so,
life into it.
I mean, can you trace that? Like, is it one particular video, or is it just a trend? Like, do you know what happened? Like, what's the day one of this suddenly... kids
I've no idea why it was this song. I've no idea why it was this song that was chosen for it. No idea. It appeared one day during, you know, the Pedro Pascal 2 months that we all had on TikTok, and it's just been so lovely to see the young people kind of be like, wait a minute, this song is actually good, who is this person, and then learning about her. And yeah.
It's funny how this stuff happens. So
I know. I'm just so fascinated by how they, like, this is what crate digging is now for kids. It's like, I say kids, you know, I hope, if there are any Gen Zers listening, I hope they don't think I'm being patronizing. But yeah, I'm so fascinated by like this and Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. And just, it's like, why these songs? Like, what is it about these songs? Because we know they're great. Our parents know they're great. But it's like every generation that comes is kind of finding new ways to discover them. And it's not through their parents' record collections. It's through memes on TikTok. It's funny.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting. It's just like, how does it happen? How does it
happen?
Why one thing over another? It's very, very interesting.
Yeah. Why that song and not another one of her songs? Like, it's, yeah. It's,
I wonder,
very
was it used in a show or anything like that? Or, you know,
well, that song has been used a lot in television. Did you watch Lost?
Yeah, I did. But I mean, that was a long time ago.
So do you remember your man, was he Scottish? Your man down in the bunker.
Yeah.
The first episode that you meet him, it's playing while he's, I think he's like doing stuff all day. And you know, the way he has to keep resetting the thing, and that song is playing.
That's,
I can't remember whether it's playing like diegetically or not, but that's the song. Yeah, yeah. So, and it's been used in loads of other television shows. I was looking at the wiki today. I can't remember any of them now, but I remember from Lost, from watching it the first time. But I don't know, like, I guess when Lost first came out, I was like, that's old people music.
Yeah.
But because I was young. But But yeah, so 1970 comes along and she's got one album left before she's out of her contract with this label, who clearly either don't care about her or are annoyed with her for not giving them what they want. And so she does what any artist in that situation would do and releases basically like a best of sort of thing. Mama's Big Ones came out in 1970. The label felt that kind of message driven records, I think was the phrase I read, were over. They were done. It's not the 60s anymore. Now we're into the era of love songs. So they wanted her to sing some love songs. So they released this kind of compilation record that would free her from her contract of love songs and previously released songs that she had. They didn't include California Earthquake, but they did include Mama's and Papa's hit Words of Love, which featured her as a lead vocalist. So I don't know whether that's them digging, you know, the boot in and being like, you should have sounded more like the Mamas and Papas, but that's how I read it anyway. Then she records an album with who did she record the album with? Sorry, one second. Yeah, Dave Mason. Sorry, I didn't have it in my, she records an album with Dave Mason, and then she signs with RCA, with whom she released two commercially unsuccessful albums. But around that time, she was kind of like entering into the world of cabaret and singing standards at shows and kind of leaving pop and rock music altogether. And she took a show to Las Vegas and was accused of selling out. And there's a really cool interview with her. She's on some late night talk show and she's just such joy in those interviews at that stage. But talking about like, oh, well, what do you say to people who say that, like, you've sold out and you sold out in the counterculture? And she was talking about how when she was in the Mamas and the Papas, there was this kind of marketing of them as like this kind of madcap, like family, like of hippies. And she was like, I wasn't a hippie. I did like musical theater. And that was just what was in at the time. And that's the way we dressed and people liked it. So we did it, but I wasn't a hippie. And so you could say that I've kind of, you know, I'm not selling out. I'm just returning to like my roots, which I think is really nice. So she gets rave reviews for her show in Las Vegas. The Las Vegas Sun wrote, Cass Elliot, making a strong point that she is no longer Mama Cass, has a good act serving notice that she is here to stay. The audience was with her all the way, no empty seats anywhere. And the final record that she would release was called Don't Call Me Mama Anymore, which was the name of the show that she was... that she put on, and it was a live album of those songs that were recorded in Chicago. But her Vegas time, I won't go into too much of it again for time. There's really a lot to say about her, but I mean, the run up to Vegas when she was starting the, I suppose today you'd call it a residency, was very, very difficult for her. She basically went on this like crash diet where she wouldn't eat for like 4 days a week, and she cut out all white food. And it was, you know, it was like today we'd call it eating disorder behavior. But then she very, very openly spoke about it on talk shows. She was constantly asked about her weight and what she's doing and what her diet is. And she was just so like open to discussing it and so graceful about how she discussed it and how she answered questions like that I can just imagine if anyone ever asked me a question as personal as any of that, I would just flip out and start flipping desks. But she was just so graceful about it. But yeah, so that kind of yo-yo dieting and crash dieting up to and during the Vegas shows is thought to be the reason that she died at 32. Like, that message was clear. She died because she was fat, and it was the gleeful kind of reportage of the death of a 32-year-old mother. And it's kind of only in recent years that the music industry has been like held to account for, not for her. I still think that she is owed like full written apologies in many print publications around the world. But it's only kind of in recent years that we are starting to see pop stars being treated as people.
Yeah.
And when I say recent years, I really mean recent. I'm talking about Billie Eilish. I'm talking about Lizzo. Like, I'm talking about people who they themselves haven't been playing ball with the idea that you have to fit a certain mold or look a certain way in order to be a pop star. And, you know, if you take someone like Lizzo, it's very much part of her branding, I suppose. I don't mean that in a you know,
cynical way, yeah.
In a bad way, in a cynical way, but it is, it's part of her, it's part of who she is. And she does a lot for, you know, normalizing fat bodies in the media, which is amazing. And then you've someone like Billie Eilish who decided to just not let anybody see what shape her body was at all for many years while she was young. And that in itself was a really fascinating commentary on how we treat young women's bodies in the industry. But yeah, so I think it is changing, but I guess with Cass Elliot, there's a lesson there in terms of like how we treat women, how we treat fat women, how we treat people who have died, and to not make people the butt of jokes and to take them seriously. And it's just, she had a very, very, very sad life. And it's kind of compounded by the sadness of knowing that if she existed today, things would only be marginally better for her, you know? Yeah. So I mean, that's...
Yeah, in a way, it takes the TikTok generation to shine a light on an artist that was unfairly treated. And this piece here says, I mean, the song has been featured in it. At this point, this was March when this came out, at least 46,000 videos, over 32 million views. So that song has been heard by a lot of people. And Cass Elliot's daughter, Owen Elliot Kugel, said, it's the coolest thing.
Owen Elliot is a fucking legend, oh, really? By the way. Like, yeah, I'll tell you about Owen Elliot in a minute, okay. But yeah, go on.
The quote is, it's the coolest thing I could possibly even conceptualize. I'm a total TikTok junkie and I'm in love, and I'm loving in particular the context that people are using the song, because it's completely accurate in the whole attitude. Make your own kind of music is really about like, fuck you. I'm going to do whatever I want, no matter what anyone thinks. One of my main goals in my life is make sure that her legacy stays prominent and alive. The thing that people connect with about my mom is the idea that triumphing over adversity. She was a woman in a man's world who paved the way for other women of size, and that's really important.
Yeah, Owen Elliott is amazing. So I was watching a TikTok video today of somebody kind of giving fun. Remember I was saying earlier that people think that she was kicked out of the band. So somebody had made a video, like in good faith, but just not very well researched, a young person saying like, oh yeah, and she was kicked out of the band and that's really sad. And then you just see Owen Elliott commenting on the TikTok being like, my mom left the band to go solo. She didn't get kicked out. And I clicked through and it's her. Like, and she's amazing. She gave the speech when Cass was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and was just so eloquent. She looks exactly like her mom. Like, she's like the spitting image of her. Like, it's crazy. And she's really great. She's done loads of work in terms of making sure that her legacy is understood, and that her contributions to the band were properly kind of understood. And yeah, I like that she says that she was a woman in a man's world, because there are a lot of women who in that counterculture paved the way, but a lot of those women also had privileges that weren't afforded to women like Cass, because she was a larger woman, and that aren't afforded to Black women and aren't afforded to all these kind of other, you know, there's an intersectionality when it comes to Cass Elliot that I think is really important to engage with when we're talking about, you know, quote unquote women in music, and that we're not just talking about one kind of woman in music all the time. And yeah, and I mean when I was reading all of this today, I got really sad for just that it was all it all felt like it was for nothing, you know, like when I think about the 1990s, and I mean, I know the 1990s and the 2000s were a particularly difficult time to be a girl or a woman or to be somebody who was into pop music or pop culture at all. And when you look at what pop stars looked like during those years and what people on television look like during those years, through today's lens, it can genuinely be quite shocking to see how thin people on television are and how thin pop stars were and how small Britney Spears was, and like that she was a kid, and Christina Aguilera, and all of them, like, and that it was just so normalized, and that it just felt like it was going backwards. But I think the shock factor of that, of looking at that now, maybe indicates that we're moving into a space where, you know, fatphobia is still absolutely 100% exists in our society, and it's everywhere, and you see it in the backlash towards the really, really important work that fat activists are doing to dismantle that. But I guess at least now we're having conversations about it. At least now it's not okay to put a red circle around somebody's thigh if they have cellulite, or, you know, if they put on a bit of weight. It's just that's not accepted anymore. But yeah, I don't know. It made me sad for the 90s, made me hopeful for the future, and definitely for the kids that are coming up now who are embracing Cass Elliot, which just makes me so happy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy how these things come back out of nowhere, seemingly, and then there's a renaissance of some kind. But yeah. That's really fascinating. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that story. I hadn't completely missed it because I am not on TikTok anymore. Well, I am, but I don't use it. So I had seen it.
I mean,
I had seen the meme, but like,
maybe down the road I'll go into like the other parts of her life, which are, you know, equally or like more fascinating kind of plot wise, but maybe a bit more complicated and tricky, you know, social commentary wise.
Yeah.
Like she held a lot of parties. It was like Cass's house, like, was like, she, you know, every star in the 1960s you could imagine went to parties at her house. And she knew quite well both the victims and the perpetrators of the Manson murders, you know, like, so she was really entrenched in that whole environment, like that whole scene, like she was in there. And yeah, I mean, just like one thing about her arrest in England. So the Mamas and Papas arrived, I think, on boat, and to play some shows or something. I think it might have been Liverpool, and the cops were waiting for them after they got off the boat to arrest her for like having drugs. So they're like, the band are trying to, like, you know, throw away their bags of weed or whatever. Like it was like when the Beatles were arrested. Yeah. Like it was just, they just had weed on them. Like it was nothing. So they arrest her anyway, and she spends a night in a cell, and then she's released. And on her way out, there's like paparazzi images, or like, you know, newsy images of her walking out eating a cookie. And it's like a weed cookie that they just didn't confiscate from her because they didn't know. And so she's like leaving the police station and eating it. And nobody knew at the time that that's what it was. And there's like pictures of her from, like, you know, 15, 20 minutes later with the band. And I don't know if it's the way she's photographed, but she looks like she's high and happy to be out of jail. So that's how I think of her.
That's good.
But yeah, oh, she's amazing. And I mean, God, if you just search any, like, obviously a lot of the interviews are tinged with, like, you know, the gross questions that she's asked about her weight and stuff. But she is a really enjoyable person to watch being interviewed, especially later on in her career, when she just has this, like, this confidence and this grace and this, like, ownership of who she is and her body and her work. And she's a really, really fascinating person to see talk. And I got really sad because I saw this video of her in an interview saying, oh, I'm going to be 33 in September. And of course she wouldn't, because she'd die before then. And it was so close to when she died. And I was just like, my God, like it's fascinating to have this footage of her, like, and just to know and understand that she had no idea. There was no way that anyone was going to know. It wasn't like she was like extremely addicted to drugs. It wasn't like one of those things where it's like, oh well, you know, it's a tragedy but we're not surprised. It was just so sudden and so sad.
Yeah,
but yeah, she's amazing. Definitely go and deep dive into her, go and listen to her solo albums. I get a lot of joy out of them. I think they're great.
Should we play another song before we go? Let's just bookend this for a second here. Hold on, let's just do the rest of this.
Okay.
It may be rough going just to do your thing, the hardest thing to do. But you gotta make your own kind of music, sing your own special song, make your own kind of music, even if nobody else sings along.
Thank you, Andrea Cleary, and thank you, Cass Elliott, for all that. And we appreciate the deep dive into the life and times of Cass Elliott. Thanks so much. That was lovely.
Thank you very much for allowing me to just gush about her.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, and thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, yeah. Next week, we're going to be doing, I think it's the best of, because I'm away the following week. I'm on a holiday.
God, this month went quickly.
I know. Yeah, yeah. May is steaming ahead. So I think we'll do the best of next week.
May's over, man.
May's over. yeah. The grass is getting long, or has got long all month. So
yeah,
we're about to hit festival season.
So there's some
season.
People around me who are they're adhering to no mow May.
Oh yeah, I mean
in their gardens.
I get it.
Which is lovely. Very, very nice to see.
Yeah, we have a back garden, and I've cut a long section for all the bees and everything. So it's real nice.
Excellent.
And the cats very love nice. It too, don't you? Fucking weirdos.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thankfully, do you know what we won't have yet? Anyway, you're bloody leaf blowers guy. But they may be cutting the grass.
Oh yeah, no, it's only no mow May that we're adhering to in my apartment block. I reckon 1st of June they're all going to be out.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll see. But no sign of leaf blowing man just yet. But there's still time.
Never speak of his name. He will just appear. The more times you say it.
Exactly.
On the day, on the hour, he's there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's right. So it's patreon.com/909 if you do like what you, and you appreciate this podcast and the website 909.com, and you want to support us, and you want to join, more importantly as well, join our Discord, where all of the community, 909 music community, are hanging out and chatting and going to gigs together, and all the nice things that are, you know, all the nice parts of the internet without any of the badness, I mean, the toxicity.
That's exactly what it
is. So, yeah. This is where the internet still actually exists in its nice form and still be a place that exists in 2023. So patreon.com/909 if you're interested in that. And thank you to all of those who have signed up. And even if you're thinking about signing up, I appreciate your thoughts. Okay.
Thoughts and prayers.
Yeah. That's it from us this week. Thank you, Andrea. Podcast.909.com. If you have any thoughts or questions, or you want to get in touch with us about various things. So that's it from us this week.
Okay. Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.